for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Sweeping new rules governing the financial industry will become law this week when President Obama puts his signature on the bill. It comes after a year of intense wrangling among lawmakers and lobbyists, and 2 years after the near collapse of the nation's financial system. An enormous amount of work still lies ahead as the myriad details of how to implement the law are worked out. Joining me in the studio to talk about what the changes mean for the financial industry and for consumers, Damian Poletta of the Wall Street Journal, Alexis Emendinger of the National Journal, and Benjamin Applebaum of the New York Times. Before we begin our conversation with our in-studio guests, we're joined by phone from his office in Washington by Neil Woolen. He's Deputy Secretary of the Department of the Treasury. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane. Great to be here.
Thank you. Mr. Woolen, talk about the biggest culprits in the financial disaster. They seem hardly to have been changed in structure and size.
Well, I think that with respect to the financial institutions that were at the center of our financial crisis, Diane, they are going to be in a framework and governed by rules of the road that are much stronger than we've ever had before. And they will be subject to much stronger regulation with respect to capital standards, liquidity, and leverage. And they will be looked at for the first time on a consolidated basis so that regulators will be able to make sure that all of their various activities are examined with really a focus on making sure that the overall financial system, not just the institutions themselves, are being looked at.
But with the exception of creating the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, aren't you leaving the exact same regulatory agencies that got us into trouble in the first place in charge?
Well, we are going to be collapsing some of the bank regulators so that there will be fewer bank regulatory agencies for financial institutions to choose from to have them regulate those institutions. But we're also creating, and this legislation, I think, for the first time sets forward a framework amongst the regulators that will allow them, through a very strong Financial Services Oversight Council, to make sure that risk at the systemic level, at the level of the overall financial institution, gets appropriate attention. And then, of course, as you mentioned, we will be collapsing seven different pieces of consumer regulatory functions in various departments in Washington, and for the first time creating a consumer protection agency with a single focus, applying rules consistently across the entire financial system. And so in all of those ways, I think we are going to be streamlining the infrastructure of regulation and making sure that we look at both consumer protection and these big institutions from a systemic perspective.
I'm interested in when the White House might nominate someone to run the Consumer Protection Agency.
Well, of course, the president will have to make that decision, Diane, but I expect that he will want to turn to that quickly. He's got a number of very good candidates available, and I think I would expect that he will focus on this in the near term.
Is there any truth to reports that Treasury Secretary Geithner is trying to prevent Elizabeth Warren from getting a job?
No, Diane. You know, Elizabeth has been really an important force in creating the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that exists within this legislation. We've worked very closely with her over the past year and a half on that issue and to make the consumer agency a reality. You know, Secretary Geithner believes that Elizabeth is an exceptionally well-qualified person. She would be a very well-qualified leader of the Bureau. Of course, it is the President's decision, and he will have to decide who to select.
So you're saying there's absolutely no truth to that rumor?
There's no truth to that rumor.
All right. The Obama administration got most of what it wanted in this bill. Why do you believe that among consumers there's so little that average Americans think that is in that bill for them?
Well, I think that there is an enormous amount for average American consumers in this bill with respect to transparency, making sure that consumers can get and will get clear, plain disclosure with respect to credit card-related information, mortgage information, and so forth, consistency so that rules are applied across the marketplace, not just to this kind of institution or that kind of institution, but whether it's a big bank or a small bank or, for that matter, a non-bank, that the rules are applied consistently, and a consumer protection agency that has consumer protection at its as its single mission to make sure that there's someone fighting for consumers. So I think across all of those various issues, whether it comes to mortgage lending or credit card practices, the consumers will see in short order the benefits of consistent rules, of clarity, and of their being put in a position where they can make decisions about whether a credit is appropriate for them or not based on a real understanding and clarity around what their various options are.
But let me go back to my original question. Earlier this month, a Bloomberg national poll showed almost 4 out of 5 Americans surveyed said they have just a little or no confidence that the measure is going to prevent or even significantly soften a future crisis. Why doesn't the American consumer get what the White House has done here?
Well, Diane, I think I can't speak to this particular poll. And as you know, there are polls that say this and there are polls that say that. I think what's important is what's there. And what's there is a very strong set of things that will directly affect American consumers and American families and make it much easier for them to understand what's being offered to them in the marketplace, put them in a position to make decisions that are real and that have understanding behind them about their particular individual financial circumstances. And I think that's really what's important in the end. I think there are plenty of polls that suggest that this is a set of measures with respect to credit cards and mortgages that American consumers very much want and very much expect will be useful to them.
An awful lot of observers have wondered how large a role lobbyists played in formulating this bill and how much they will continue to play as details continue to be worked out.
Well, Diane, lobbyists played an awfully big role in trying to affect this bill. They spent an enormous amount of time trying to defeat it and trying to adjust it. As you noted earlier, what came out was a package that was remarkably similar to what the President put forward about 14 months ago. And so it's a very strong package of consumer protections, of stronger rules for the big financial institutions and for the ability of the financial system to pay attention to things that were previously gaps. And I think that, you know, that that's really what's important here.
How much of what's in this bill has been crafted by lobbyists and how much will continue to be affected by lobbyists?
Well, you know, I'd say 90% or more of this bill is very, very similar to what the President put forward and what the administration has been fighting for a long time. And so we feel very good about the strength of these provisions. Of course, All kinds of people tried to change this bill in various directions. But what came out in the end and what the president will sign later this week is legislation that was remarkably similar to what we sought when this process began. And as far as the rulemaking processes and the implementation processes that will now begin once the legislation is signed and enacted, I think, again, people will try to have their voices heard, but the Congress, I think, now has spoken with clarity and has set forward a framework that really provides policy direction to the various regulators that will be implementing this legislation and to the Treasury, and I would expect that we will continue to work through the details of strong regulation, making sure that the largest financial institutions have a much more robust set of things that they must abide by, but also there are that when we think about implementing the consumer pieces of this, that we insist on clarity and on simplicity and on putting forward a set of rules that allow consumers to get control of their own financial destinies. I think that is what Congress put forward in the legislation, and that's certainly what we will be focused on as we move forward now to the next stage of implementation.
And briefly, how would you respond to critics like Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who say that this is not what the economy needs right now?
Well, Diane, I think the economy needed a new set of rules, the road for the financial system, the one that the rules that we've had in the past have gotten us into a horrible mess with a tremendous financial collapse and a recession. This is a good, strong package of reforms, focusing on the consumer, making sure that the financial system overall is well protected.
All right. Neil Woolen, he's Deputy Secretary of the Treasury. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back, and now we'll turn to our in-studio guests, Damian Paletta of The Wall Street Journal, Alexis Simmendinger of The National Journal, and Benjamin Applebaum of The New York Times. We do invite your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Twitter or Facebook. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
And Damian Paletta, this question of Elizabeth Warren as head of the Consumer Protection Bureau that is being created, why is this such a controversial issue?
Some people I talked to on Friday said this could be almost like a Supreme Court nomination, because she's going to have, or whoever's appointed to this job is going to have an incredible amount of influence and discretion about the shaping of this new agency, almost like Joe Kennedy during when the SEC was created back in the 1930s. So Elizabeth Warren is someone who's taken on the banking industry for years. She's been very out front about it, and she's a long track record of standing up for these issues that she believes real strongly in. This, the whole idea of a consumer agency was her idea. And so the administration has not said who they're going to pick, although she is one of the three finalists for the job.
And who's pushing against her, Alexis?
Well, my understanding, and you've got two experts here who know a lot more about this, but my understanding is that there's a distinct differences of opinion about what the best functioning at the outset of this will be, and whether she will be a good inside player, a helpful team player, as far as the administration might be concerned. There's concern on the Hill. I cover the Senate, so there's concern on the Hill about whether she is just way, way too strident in her consumer protection attitudes to be perhaps effective in this role.
Which is presumably what consumers would want.
And I think that the decision that President Obama will have to make in a large part will have to be exactly what you were asking the Deputy Secretary to talk about. What are consumers going to trust and build confidence around? And if the public believes that she has been on their side from the beginning and that she would be marching and carrying that flag for whatever time she's in that job, the president is going to have to feel that she's built a public persona of her own. Is that a positive? Is that a net positive?
Benjamin.
This is basically the more lifeguards approach to financial reform, right? Rather than saying the industry can't do this or it can't do that or it needs to get out of this business, this bill mostly says we're going to put a lot more government regulators around the pool to watch people more closely. And so it's critical, the question of who those people are, who are the new lifeguards. That's why this Elizabeth Warren question is so important. Industry fears her. Industry does not like her.
So lobbyists are moving against her.
That's right. And so what you have basically is a determination the White House needs to make about how strong a message they want to send with that appointment. Do they want to put someone there that industry hates or someone who's seen as a more moderate figure?
And what would happen if they put a more moderate figure in there from the consumer's point of view?
We don't know, but the expectation is that someone like Warren would be much more aggressive in seeking new protections for consumers, and someone who took a more moderate course would be more responsive to industry concerns about those protections.
Damien, what is your overall impression of the bill?
After the Great Depression, they passed multiple bills. One created the FDIC, one created the SEC, another one created the Federal Housing Administration. After this recent crisis, they passed one bill that was supposed to solve all the problems, you know, derivatives, consumer protection, regulation of big banks. It's, you know, 2,000 pages. It's probably going to take a couple of years before we know whether the bill did what Democrats said it would or whether it led to what Republicans have warned it would, you know, cut off credit, or whether it's going to actually make it easier for consumers to get access to a loan. There's going to be about 500 rules written by regulators. This process is going to really drag on. But in scope, in ambition, you know, you have to give the Democrats credit for what they were able to pass. If there's going to be unintended consequences or not, it's going to take at least a year probably to know.
Unintended consequences, Alexis?
Well, it's an enormous piece of legislation that is just a basket of question marks and promises. It is Congress's effort to give a broad outline of what should be. They're not even claiming that this will prevent future meltdowns or in any way bar large financial institutions from getting into trouble again. And so much, as Damon just was referring to, so much of this will rely on the regulatory aspect of this. And for anyone in Washington who's covered or written about the very slow, glacial, snail's pace that regulatory action, especially that will be intensively followed and lobbied by the institution affected, and the long glide path for the implementation of these provisions, it seems to me that this is good intentions with a giant question mark.
Binyo, what about the areas the bill does not address?
So this was something very interesting that Neil Wolin said a moment ago, that this bill substantially resembles the administration's original proposal. That's true. It's true because most of the proposals put forward by liberals in particular to more aggressively crack down on industry, to impose additional restrictions, those didn't make the final cut. So we have proposals to require banks to get smaller, proposals to require banks to divest their operations that trade in swaps, a kind of derivatives, proposals to enforce very strict limits on the ability of banks to trade, to make their own investments, to trade alongside their customers. All of this was substantially stripped out of the final version of the legislation.
In order to get the votes necessary to pass?
That ultimately was the judgment that Democratic leaders made, was that they needed to make those changes.
What about automobile loan regulation?
That's another thing that was a significant victory for an industry, a real show of lobbying power. automobile dealers argued and convinced, in particular, many members of the House that they ought not to be placed under the jurisdiction of the new Consumer Protection Agency.
What was interesting about the auto dealers is that was an issue where the president himself came out and said, well, listen, we have to have this included in the bill. The auto dealers have to be regulated by this new consumer agency. And it wasn't even really that close. The auto dealers have such an amazing influence on the Hill because they're in everyone's district. They tend to be, you know, parts of their community where the lawmakers know them and sort of depend on them. So it wasn't even really a question towards the end. They were going to get carved out of the bill.
I talked with one Southern congressman who told me my first campaign donation ever came from an auto dealer. There was no way I was going to turn my back on them.
So what does that mean for the consumer as far as buying a car is concerned?
It means if you get your loan from a bank, you're going to enjoy more protection than if you get your loan from an auto dealer.
That's true. It's just one of these things that makes the bill so complicated is because different forms of credit are going to be probably regulated by different people. And what the administration has tried to do is consolidate, you know, the consumer interaction with the bank so that one regulator is watching it. But there's going to be other ways that are more complicated.
Damian Paletta, The Wall Street Journal, joining us now by phone is Senator Christopher Dodd. He's chair of the Senate Banking Committee. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane, and good morning to your guests as well, and thanks for having me on.
Indeed. You've said that you want the new law to rebuild trust and confidence among consumers. How do you think an average citizen is going to experience new protections this year when trust and confidence seem to be at such a low ebb?
Well, it's a great question, Diane. And I suppose the one issue, if you asked me what was the one goal I had in all of this, obviously there are details and specifics dealing with everything from derivatives and shadow banking and consumers. But the most important goal that I've had since the beginning of this process is how do you restore some level or the level of trust that existed not long ago in the financial system? And if you lack that, and I can't put a number on it for you, I can't regulate it per se. There's not a specific item I can think of at the Securities Exchange Commission or the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or any of the other organizations or regulators. But it is the essential question. If people do not trust, do not have faith in the financial system when they deposit a paycheck, buy a stock, take out a mortgage, a student loan, a car loan, then we will have not gotten the job done. So that's, to me, the quintessential goal in all of this. Now, specifically, there are four constituencies that I think come out of this process well ahead than where they were prior to the adoption of this bill and the signing of it on Wednesday. First of all, is taxpayers. Never again should the American taxpayer be asked to write a check for $700 billion to stabilize financial institutions who, in some measure or another, larger or smaller, contributed to the mess we're in. That's number one. Number two, never before in the history of the country has there been one place where consumers of financial products can feel confident that there's someone watching out for them when they start their work day in the morning, and that's all they think about all day. There have been seven different agencies that have had consumer protection divisions or bureaus, but frankly, they've been at best afterthoughts, where it's never existed in the past, where everything from abusive and scam artists with mortgages and car loans and others have been able to take advantage of people. Thirdly, you have the advantage goes to small banks. I mean, the fact that the Independent Community Bankers Association, while not endorsing the whole bill, but felt that this bill provided greater strength and greater protections for the 8,000 small banks in our country than is presently the case. And that is by having a fair assessment when it comes to supporting the FDIC, getting rid of the shadow banking so that they can have a level playing field with people who are unregulated. There's a list of items in which we specifically try to watch out for the smaller community banks in our country with assets of less than $10 billion. And lastly, a small business, including retailers. The interchange fee issue is going to make a huge difference in terms of reducing the cost for retailers, the 15 million of them in the country, who in too many cases are basically held hostage by one credit card.
Okay, a couple of
users.
All right.
Four constituencies.
Couple of questions for you. I know regulators are continuing to work out the details with lobbyists clearly working overtime to get more of what they want. You talked about the automobile industry. which has already been exempted from this whole process. So, you know, consumers right away are going to look at that and say, well, the auto dealers won and consumers lost.
No, they forgot one of the provisions. You're right. They don't get covered under the Consumer Financial Product Bureau, but there are now much tougher regulations under the Federal Trade Commission by laying aside what is called Magnuson-Moss, which put some restraints on the ability of the Federal Trade Commission to actually issue regulations and enforce them on automobiles. A little-known amendment that got adopted in the conference report was to do exactly that. That's why Sam Brownback was less than happy, because he thought he had taken care of the issue. I said, fine, I'll agree to the House provision. We had control, or that is regulation, by the automobile industry and the financing of automobiles under the Consumer Protection Bureau, but we took that out. But I strengthened the language, along with Bonnie Frank at the FTC, which, frankly, those who paid attention to it realize the FTC has historically had jurisdiction over automobile financing, but never any teeth in it to be able to do the job. They now have the teeth.
All right, Dan, let me ask you about the appointment of the person to run the Consumer Protection Agency. There's been lots of talk that Elizabeth Warren is at the top of the list, but that industry considers her too strong. Are you going to push for Elizabeth Warren?
Well, first of all, it's a presidential call. It's not my call. And Diane, like this bill, any ideas? What's the old adage in the advertising industry? No idea is terribly creative if it can't sell. And that's true of confirmation process as well. And so if people could be great nominees, and Elizabeth, I can be a terrific nominee, the question is she confirmable? And there's a serious question about it.
Why? Why is there a serious question?
I'm not arguing with it. I'm just telling you what exists. And
yeah.
So the question is, can we get someone who's confirmable? And she may be, but that's not the only potential nominee. There are many fine nominees.
Sure. What's going against her, Senator Dodd?
I don't know. I'm just telling you what I'm picking up, and that we'll have to watch how the process unfolds. But the president's got to make the call, and he hasn't asked me my advice or opinion on it. As to what it is, I presume at some point they may, and obviously if the votes are there for, then he wants to make the nomination, he can move forward. But I'm not going to second guess him.
Okay.
I don't think it's limited to one person either. I get a little concerned when people think there's only one individual who can do this job. That's not true.
How helpful was it to you in getting this bill passed to have announced that you would not seek re-election?
Well, that's a tough call. I don't know. You know, I suspect, that the way politics is today, that no matter what I advocated or supported, there'd be people trying to interpret that as some sort of a political move one way or the other. In the 30 years I've been in the Senate, I've never let politics or financing have any impact whatsoever on votes I've cast or positions I've taken. And I'm offended that people would even think that after this many years. But nonetheless, by not being a candidate, it certainly removed the argument that anyone could make about the bill, and I think that might have had some impact. But candidly, the bill was took a lot of work by a lot of colleagues in the Senate as well as House. Bonnie Frank did a great job in the House, and I had strong support from my committee members. Unfortunately, my Republican colleagues never offered any substitute or any alternative idea. And in fact, the day the committee was considering the markup of the bill, they filed 401 amendments on the Friday before the markup beginning on Monday night and never offered one of them. During the committee. That was their call, not mine. I can't stop someone from offering an amendment in a markup. And then I went to the floor, and I insisted upon an open process so that every single amendment, all 60 of them, 30 of them were offered by Republicans or bipartisan amendments, which were adopted in the Senate debate over 4 weeks. Only one amendment that was offered had a tabling motion to it, that is to try and get rid of the amendment early on, and only one amendment required more than 60 votes. In the conference committee, 179 amendments were offered between the House and the Senate. Again, open process, the first time a conference has ever been on C-SPAN. In terms of this being open and people understanding what was unfolding, I think it was about as good a process and demonstration.
All right, and
can do things in public.
One last question for you. If, as some people want to speculate, that Republicans should take over the House and the Senate, is there a possibility that this whole process could be repealed?
Well, I was somewhat amused. I, because John Boehner, who I know and like, the congressman who's one of the leaders or the leader of the Republicans in the House, even before the bill passed, he announced he was going to repeal it. And I think you do so at your peril. I'm not suggesting everyone agreed with it. You know, Republicans voted or at least created the first two titles of the bill dealing with too big to fail and the resolution mechanism. They made a lot of contributions to this bill. I can't believe anyone wants to go back to the status quo that existed prior to the passage of this bill, when taxpayers were exposed, consumers had no protection, no place where someone would fight for them, where retailers were paying outrageous prices because of the credit card industry, and small businesses paying additional costs. So all of that would be adversely affected by this bill. And that has to do with our economy and job growth as well. So I think that's more of a political statement. I can't imagine they'd even succeed if they tried it.
Senator Christopher Dodd, he's chair of the Senate Banking Committee. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Diane, very, very much. My best to your hosts, your guests on the show as well.
Thank you. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
As traditional news outlets cut back, some say the future of journalism is in trouble. Others say not so fast. How not-for-profit news organizations are reviving local news coverage and in-depth investigative journalism. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And it's time to open the phones for our guest here in the studio, Alexis Semendinger. She's Senate correspondent for the National Journal. Binyamin Applebaum, he's a reporter for the New York Times. Damian Paletta is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Earlier, you heard from Neil Woolen, Deputy Secretary of Treasury, and U.S. Senator Christopher Dodd. He's Connecticut Democrat and chair of the Senate Banking Committee. Let's go first to a caller in Cleveland, Ohio, and let's see if this is going to work. Good. Sarah, you're on the air.
Okay, great. Thank you. Great show. I just wanted to know if your guests could speak to the issue of what this legislation does, if anything, to protect savers. It sounds like a great piece of legislation for borrowers, but many Americans have been chastened by the crisis and are trying to save instead of borrow. And many baby boomers are forced to be investment experts via their 401ks. And so does it do anything to eliminate the inherent conflict of interest with securities rating agencies like Standard & Poor's and Moody's being funded by the very companies they rate?
Benjamin.
So a couple pieces there. As far as savers go, if you have a bank account, it's already been protected up to $100,000. That now increases to $250,000 on a permanent basis.
But you're
that
not
money's
getting
safe.
Very much interest on that savings
No, you are
account.
Not. So if you go ahead and you want to put your money in the market and you're working through, you know, an investment advisor or a mutual fund company, those companies are subject to some additional regulation. There will be a study of whether they should be subject to a requirement known as fiduciary duty, meaning that they need to act in your interest. They aren't right now. Your broker might fall under that requirement eventually. Your investment advisor might fall under that requirement eventually. So the bill creates opportunities for increased protections. It imposes some increased protections in limited areas. But this is another thing that's really going to depend on the regulators to determine how much in the way of additional protections comes into effect.
One other thing I was going to suggest is to watch for is savers who use banks to save. Already there have been news reports, including in the New York Times, about how the big banks are already moving to raise fees to recoup what they anticipate that will be lost to them in terms of the opportunities they had. So consumers may find that that in terms of doing business with banks, there are more fees attached to their accounts.
Even as interest rates stay at the lowest they've been a long time. Here's an email from David in Denver, North Carolina, who says any bill that doesn't address Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is a joke. They played a large part in the housing meltdown. They're not touched mainly because they're favored by Dodd and Barney Frank. What's your reaction, Damien?
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were almost, they were such a part of this process in that they were invoked, you know, every 5 minutes during the debate. And I think Democrats knew that it would have been politically impossible for them to pass a bill that tried in any way to deal with Fannie and Freddie. Fannie and Freddie, these giant mortgage finance companies that are being run by the government, they were taken over during the financial crisis and they're, you know, costing the taxpayer billions of dollars. The administration has said they want to come up with a process to address these companies but in the next year, but the Republicans really, you know, hammered on Democrats for not, you know, tackling these issues.
To Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Janice.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Diane, for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a couple of questions, and they have to do with the consumer aspects of the new bill. And I wondered if, you know, credit cards are usually regulated by the state. That is, the state prosecutes the credit card companies for fraud and takes complaints from consumers. Is that going to change in the new bill?
Your credit card, the fees you pay, that will be regulated by the new Consumer Protection Bureau. They'll have to write new rules, and there'll be a whole process where everyone will get to weigh in. But the credit card contract that you have with your bank will be regulated by the new agency.
Right. And so will they have places where one can make complaints, or will that be handled by the FBI?
That actually is one of the big new things that this bill sets up. One of the first things this Consumer Protection Bureau is going to establish is a call center, a place that consumers can send complaints about financial products. So that will exist in the not-too-distant future.
As we heard Senator Dodd speaking, he seemed to imply great doubts about Elizabeth Warren as the head of this consumer protection agency. Is that because she's simply been too tough? He said, you know, he implied the confirmation process is going to be tough. As you've said, Alexis, maybe this doesn't ring out there in the great general public, but for this consumer protection agency, it could mean whether it's truly got teeth or not, Binya.
Listen, critics of Professor Warren make a couple of points about her. One is that she doesn't have experience running a bureaucracy. She's a Harvard professor, an academic primarily for most of her career. A second point is
same thing they say about our new Supreme Court justice.
Mm-hmm. Another point that they make is that she doesn't have what they view as sufficient sympathy for the importance of banks in the economy, that she has at times taken a perspective that is anti-bank in their minds, and that they don't feel that she would be able to balance the interests of both sides in that equation. Her supporters feel very strongly that she is the person best suited to run that agency, that she has an empathy for the needs of consumers that has been missing from the regulatory structure in Washington. She's obviously the person most responsible for the creation of this agency, for the idea of it, and they feel strongly that she would be the best person to implement it. It's an interesting debate because it really gets back to this issue of we have a bill, it lays out broad outlines, and what it means is going to be determined by who gets appointed to run it and how they go forward from here. So what we have right now is an outline, and the extent of the fight over Warren really highlights how far along we are in the process, which is to say, not very far right now.
Alexis.
I thought the one interesting thing listening to Senator Dodd is that he could have stopped after he said that it is President Obama's choice, but he then weighed in to talk about his sense that she's not confirmable, which would suggest that he's signaling very strongly to the White House that she not be the choice.
What's really going to be really interesting with this decision, if the administration wants to pick a political fist fight with Republicans, you know, they're trying to get their poll numbers back up, and there's only a couple months to do it. If they appointed Elizabeth Warren and they could say, hey, we picked the toughest person for the job, we dare you to go out there and criticize someone who's made their career out of advocating for consumers. I mean, that could be kind of an interesting, you know, political theater to play out over the next couple
months. All right, to Indianapolis. Good morning, Rodney. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You did actually help answer some of my question earlier, but quick comment. I consider myself a fiscal conservative, so if we don't have it, don't spend it. Number two, is it an urban legend or is it really true that the government kind of created this monster years ago, whether it was under Bush or Clinton, as far as the mortgage crisis and putting people in houses that really couldn't afford them and the pressure on banks and loan companies to do that that helped create this, or is that just kind of an urban legend?
There is no question, I think, that federal policy over several decades has strongly favored home ownership in ways that helped to inflate the bubble by encouraging mortgage lending, by holding down interest rates, by providing huge tax deductions to homeowners, enabling people to shelter a portion of the proceeds of a sale of a house from capital gains. There were a lot of things the government did that really made home ownership more desirable and helped to inflate this housing bubble. So in that sense, yes. There's a much more contentious fight over whether specific government requirements on some banks to increase lending for affordable housing played a role in inflating the bubble. The best research I've seen on it seems to conclude pretty clearly that that was not the case. The role played by lenders subject to that requirement was very small relative to the broader mortgage market. But that's become a political football in its own right.
Thanks for your call, Rodney. And here's an email from Pat in St. Louis, Missouri, who says, we know the big banks and Wall Street will spend millions of dollars to invent ways around the regulations, as they always do. What will be left will be layers of rules that will make it harder and more costly for the average American to get a car loan or set up a payment agreement with their dentist. Do you believe that to be so?
That's kind of the horror story that we heard in the last week or two of debate, that this is going to make it so complicated to get credit that, you know, if you need brace, your child needs braces for their teeth, it's going to be so complicated in order to get the loan from the dentist to do so.
So is that an urban legend or is that the truth?
I mean, the problem is it's going to take a couple of years until we really know. They have to set up the new rules. They have to pick the regulators. They have to write these new policies. I think it's unlikely that dental care is going to greatly go up in cost because of this bill. But if you listen to, you know, some people that have really been raising warnings, I mean, the dentists did lobby on this bill. And so they must have been concerned about something.
If the fear is that this bill is going to make it easier for lenders to abuse consumers and harder for consumers to get fair and fairly priced loans, that would represent such a remarkable inversion of the intent of the legislation that something would have had to go horribly wrong in its architecture. It's a fear that's out there. It's a little bit hard to imagine how you could aim at one purpose and end up achieving the diametrically opposed outcome.
Well, that's what I'm interested in. Why is there such fear out there? that that's what's happening.
You know, I think one simple answer is that there's a lot of fear of government and the expansion of government. And what Republicans, there was a period earlier this year when it seemed like it was going to be political suicide to oppose this legislation, that a lot of Republicans were going to fall in line and support it. And what we saw at the end in these last couple of weeks, as Damian was just saying, was this remarkably confident, strong, loud opposition from Republicans. And the bet they were making is that people are more angry at government and more scared of government than they are angry at Wall Street and scared of Wall Street.
This is, if we can inject politics into it for a minute, the polls are so interesting on this because what we were just talking about is absolutely right. If you talk about the stimulus and the lack of public confidence or even being persuaded that it's helped at all, healthcare reform, the public's impression of healthcare reform has gotten more negative, not more positive. Most people in polls are saying they think it's hurting them. Two-thirds of those who were polled by CBS News in the most recent poll, two-thirds of them said that this financial regulation legislation will not improve the economy or their place in the economy, even though a majority said it's right to do more regulatory legislation.
So the naysayers have outshouted the supporters. Is that where we are?
They just don't see. They don't see the benefits. What was the most popular legislation that the Senate approved in 2009? It was not any of the big things that President Obama
Healthcare.
Originated. It was cash for clunkers was the most popular because people thought they got something directly.
Alexis Emendinger of the National Journal. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And here's another email, this one from Oscar regarding Elizabeth Warren. He says she is exactly who we need to run the new agency. If she is appointed, this agency will be the first in history to operate in the people's interest and not be bought by the industry it regulates. So perhaps her name and her reputation have indeed begun to resonate out there. That doesn't mean she's confirmable.
But remember, this is a 5-year appointment, so she could, if Obama's not reelected, she would stay in that job throughout the next administration. I mean, it's a really influential position.
All right, and finally to Syracuse, New York. Good morning, Kyle.
Thank you, Diane. I just find it interesting that we talk about these large banks and financial institutions and the people who work to think about this. There are a lot of very bright people, very educated, very driven, very focused, who are being told that or we're being told that we're trying to avoid them destroying the economy again. I guess I don't know that I don't trust, and now I'm not supposed to trust this legislation that's supposed to help rein them in. I guess it's a conversation that is. I guess I don't know who to take to their word. I work for a small company, and we work hard every day to do better, not destroy what we're working on.
And that is such an eloquent comment. We don't know who to trust anymore, is what he and a great many other people are saying. Alexis, it would seem to me that the administration, the Senate, the House, the federal government have an awful lot to prove here, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And that's why I was listening very carefully to Senator Dodd when you were asking him to explain what's in this for the average person. Let's say this year it happens to be a midterm election year. You would expect that Democrats would find a way to sell this. I know I've been told by Democratic senators they think that this is going to be a big seller during their campaigns up to the election time. So I listened carefully, and I didn't hear that simple explanation that most average consumers, you know, like the gentleman who just was calling, are looking for to ask, you know, and answer that question, what's in it for me?
There's a very interesting sort of political critique of this process, which says that Democrats have not done enough to establish a consensus narrative of what happened during the financial crisis, and that has made it harder for them to sell their solution as the best possible solution. So during the Great Depression, we saw, you know, a series of hearings, famous hearings, where the public was sort of informed and educated about what had transpired, and public support was built for a response to those identified problems. Here, we sort of have a simultaneous process of hearings about what happened during the crisis and legislation to address it. And it may be that there will be a political price to pay for failing to have convinced the public that you understood what went wrong before you set about trying to fix it.
One of the things that I think we all remember about the financial crisis was how it shook everyone's confidence in the government, in big banks, and everything to its core, and that's never really recovered. And what must be really confusing for people across the country is to hear really smart people on both sides say this bill is going to do completely opposite things.
Damian Paletta of the Wall Street Journal, Alexis Simendinger of the National Journal, Benjamin Applebaum of the New York Times. Thank you all. I remain very concerned about what comes next. We shall see. Thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.